This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. First Draft highlights the voices of writers as they discuss their work, their craft, and the literary arts. My guest is Valeria Luiselli, essayist and fiction writer. Her books include Sideways, Faces in the Crowd, Tell Me How It Ends, an essay in 40 questions, The Story of My Teeth, and The Lost Children Archive. She was born in Mexico and grew up in the U.S., South Korea, Costa Rica, South Africa, Spain, France, India, and Mexico. Her novel, The Lost Children Archive, tells the story of an unnamed family of four who drive from New York to Arizona to follow and document stories. The father is making a sound documentary about the downfall of the Apaches and the death of Geronimo. The mother is making a sound documentary about the immigration crisis at the border, with a particular focus on the separation of parents and children. We began the interview with Valeria Luiselli talking about her upbringing and her parents.
My parents worked in NGOs for a long time, and that's how we began moving around from place to place. Well, actually, for the first time we ever left Mexico, I was 2 years old, and we came here to the U.S. My father had studied a PhD in Madison, Wisconsin. So he came here, I guess, to finish his dissertation. I actually don't know, and I should know. I should ask him why we were here when I was two. But after that, it was NGOs mostly. And then in 1989, there was a new president in Mexico, the not very well-esteemed Salinas de Gortari. And him and my father knew each other from childhood. My father had been in politics earlier on when he was very young. And I think they didn't like each other very much. So Salinas kind of, I guess it was like a far away, so close kind of move. So he was sent as far away as possible from Mexico, which was South Korea then, a country that didn't have at that moment too many relations with Mexico. But when I say far away, so close, I also mean kind of close, kind of under the umbrella of the Mexican government, right? So he was a diplomat there. And then some years later, he was asked as well through NGOs to be one of the international observers in the Mandela elections in South Africa. And so he was there. He participated as an observer in the elections. And after that, he was asked to open up the first Mexican embassy. He was asked by the Mexican government to open up the first Mexican embassy. There wasn't any embassy during apartheid, of course. Mexico never supported the apartheid. So then I ended up moving with my father there in 1994, at the same time as my mother decided to move to Chiapas in southern Mexico, joining the Zapatista army. She became very involved with a Zapatista movement and insurgents, and she decided she had a political calling and moved to Chiapas. So after that, when I ended up living in India, but that was by myself in a boarding school. So as you can hear, just different reasons, different moments of life.
I mean, I could see how that international and also probably liberal bent in your family really influenced your writing.
You know, more than liberal, I would say. I mean, my mom was pretty radical, or is, and like radical left. And I come from a lineage of women who have always worked very closely with indigenous communities in Mexico. And in political movements related to the defense of rights of indigenous peoples in Mexico. So my grandmother was very involved with a community in Puebla. My great-grandmother had been from Pachuca nearby, and she was Otomi, an indigenous Otomi woman. And from her down, basically, all the women in my family have, in different senses, been very involved politically with their communities.
Would you consider The Lost Children Archive activist fiction?
I don't know. I don't know that that exists. I think I am an activist. But I am also a writer, and I'm also an educator. And so I think all those things intersect to produce whatever it is that I write. I don't think, and I'm very careful about not writing fiction from the platform of my, I would say, I mean, definitely from the platform of my politics, but not as a way to state my politics, right? I think that fiction needs to breathe and needs to flow. And when there is a very clear political objective in fiction, that often suffocates prose and suffocates rhythm and other important components of the freedom that fiction, I think, should have. So I actually stopped writing this novel at some point because I realized that I was really, really angry politically with what was happening in the border of the US and Mexico. And I was trying to use the novel as a vehicle for my political standpoints, and I was really just killing it. So I stopped and I wrote Tell Me How It Ends, a much more straightforward political/personal essay on immigration and particularly on child refugees. And once I did that, you know, once I was able to put in a non-fictional, very straightforward form what I thought about the refugee crisis in the border, I was able to go back to the novel and write it without having to, I don't know, explain the history of U.S. interventions in Central America and so on and so forth.
The Lost Children Archive tells the story from two different points of view, first a mother and then a son. And it's a family of four. It's a mixed family. So they married later and each came with a child. They're all unnamed. And the man and wife are like documentarians of sound. And they are going on a road trip from New York to the West, to Arizona, to document. The husband is documenting the Apache downfall and Geronimo's death and the echoes of that. And the mother is focusing on the border crisis and the children that are separated from their parents at the border.
I would just add that the family is going through a crisis of its own. The narrator and wife is splitting from her husband, or in a moment in which they will probably decide to leave each other. And that crisis grows as they drive deeper into the country.
So how did you alight on the main narrator, the female mother's voice? And how did you begin this? We're so into her mind and her feelings, and there's a lot of empathy that we can feel because it's so deep.
It's a good question. I usually take notes for a very long time before I start writing a new book. And when I say a long time, I mean a year at least. With this book, it was a year. And that doesn't mean that I stopped writing notes when I started writing on the computer. But first, before anything, there was this long process of just note taking. And in fact, my notes are usually in at least Spanish and English. And one of the questions holding me back from just jumping in and starting to write the novel, like write at least on the computer and with a different kind of rhythm, was not knowing which of the two languages I needed to use for this particular novel. And it was really like a year and a little bit after I started writing those notes that I was in Berlin and had some, I guess, linguistic distance from both languages. And I sat down and finally heard it very clearly in my head. And by that time, I had accumulated a lot of observations about children, not necessarily my own, about relationships, about the interaction between politics and
or the sphere of politics and private family life, and the way that the two worlds collide and are not at all, as sometimes seems, separate. And it was because I had, I guess, so many threads when I started writing, I was able to, it's as if it had already, part of it had already been kind of written, right? I mean, part of them, there was something that I was following something, some kind of thread. And it wasn't a thread in terms of plot. I very, very seldom think about plot. Rather, I think about it as a way to solve, like to get me from A to B, where A and B are usually questions or intuitions or kind of topics I want to explore, but definitely not questions I want to answer, just questions that I maybe want to just explore, right?
Did you always know it was going to be in this voice?
Not always, but as soon as during that summer in Berlin I started writing, I knew that that was at least one of the voices. And I mean, I never know where I'm going to go when I start a book. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, and definitely don't know how it's going to end. I have some very basic intuitions and some questions that I don't even know how to articulate in a very precise way, but it's a kind of question intuition that I want to explore, and that's how I jump into the text. And I would see no other way for me to write, because I think knowing too much is pretty boring, right? It's kind of when you set off on a journey, not knowing where you're going to exactly and what's going to happen is part of the beauty, right? And the mystery and the meaningfulness of travel. And I think writing, or at least for me, it's very similar. So I didn't know, but at some point, as I told you, I heard that voice and it was able to carry me on. And at some point in the novel, I also realized that there had to be another voice aside from hers, because the novel, I realized at some point, was very much fundamentally about the interactions of stories that we pass on to children and then children pass back on to us, right? And how we thread the world or a version of the world in that interaction, right? I mean, after all, I guess words are what connect our minds, right? I mean, this conversation, this connection between your mind and mine and that of the readers is the threads of words, right? So that's what we have. And the novel explores that very insistently, right? The way we tell each other things, what we pass on with a story. So I knew at some point there had to be the other side of that threading. And I thought about the little girl who was 5 years old in the story, but thought, I tried her voice a little bit, but it's very difficult to sustain a five-year-old narration, right? It's not, I mean, it would probably be too cutesy. Second, it might be just very garbled or just a beautiful fragmented mess, but I needed something else. I didn't want it to be the narrator's husband for different reasons. I mean, partly because they've talked enough, right? Men in literature, we have so many male narrators. And I wanted him to be a kind of silent figure, silent presence. So I decided on the little boy who is at the same time kind of talking to his sister, right? Passing on the stories that the story the way he sees it to his little sister, whom he thinks won't remember this road trip because she's only five. So his theory is that the kids start remembering things at six, or recording them in their minds at six. He's very categorical about this, and so decides to give his version to his sister so that she can remember that version of the story.
So you were trying to choose a language and you wrote it in English. Did you ever feel like English was at a loss? Like, were you ever frustrated because Spanish could say something that English couldn't?
I think that happens to anyone who speaks two languages or more. There's always a language in which you can say something very precisely and clearly, and then another in which you can say something different, precisely and clearly, but not that other thing, right? There seems to be like opaque areas in one language that are not in another, and just words that are perfectly suited for one particular concept in a language and not in another. So there's always a frustration in bilingualism where one language is always not enough. But I guess the luminous side of that is that it forces you to seek ways in the language in which you're writing to say exactly what you want to say, and then really kind of carve something out of what you do have, and maybe take not the direct route, but other more unexpected, perhaps more winding routes to say that which you know can be said precisely and clearly, but you're not finding it in a direct sense, at least. So I think that there's something to be gained from that frustration too.
One of the major, it's not just a trope, it's also the structure of your book, is the idea of an archive, and documenting things is what makes an archive. So I'm curious about your interest in documentation and then archiving them.
Yeah, it is a trope, and it's also just that the structure of the novel is very much... the architecture of the novel has a lot to do with or is in close resemblance to how one might open up a box full of someone else's archive, right, and try to make sense of the bits and pieces and try to compose some kind of narrative, right? So, I mean, the novel is, as I was saying earlier, very much a meditation about composing stories, right, threading narrative. And I wanted the bits and pieces with which I composed this story to be present in their raw way somehow, believing that in doing so, there can always be a very fertile interaction between a reader's mind and that material that's more raw and not threaded already by me, not arranged in a particular order by me, but somehow just there, standing on its own, and so that reader's mind could think of connections that I don't see between things, or can even just perhaps feel curious about those things and be able to then go off, sort of exit the space of this book and enter the space of someone else's work. I usually like books that take me to other books, not books that are sort of closed in within themselves, but are kind of open and porous and lead elsewhere. So I usually try to write things that do something similar.
One of the focuses is childhood and parenthood, and that child-adult relationship, and what it means to be a parent, and what it means to be a child with a parent, without a parent, children alone in the world. So these were a lot of the major questions that your novel asks and grapples with and asks the reader to think about. And I understand that you spent lots of time at the border, so that's a clear link to what the things that you've been thinking about. But I'm also curious about just your interest in parenthood and children alone in the world.
Yeah, well, there's two sides of that question, and well, many possible answers, but at least two possible answers. I mean, yes, on the one hand, this novel is also a piece of archive, I guess, right? It documents to a certain... It's not a novel about immigration, but it does document a moment in history that we are witnessing right now, right? Although I must say that when I started writing this novel, it was 2014, so long before, somehow feels like long before the Trump era. And not to say that there weren't separations at the border or atrocities happening to children who were attempting to seek asylum here. It was all happening back then. But of course, the situation became a lot worse, and it has become a lot worse in the past couple of years. But I never thought that what I was writing about was going to continue to be a crisis, an ongoing crisis, and that it was going to get worse, right? So I wasn't really thinking about about some kind of timeliness. And in fact, I would say again what I said earlier. This is not a novel about immigration. It's a novel with immigration, right? And it grapples more with the question of how or of what bearing witness means than with the question of the immigration crisis itself, right? And in that sense, I was thinking about how to tell the story of children going through the trauma of having to flee their homes, cross a country that is very dangerous for migrants, let alone minors, and then arrive in a country that is not going to welcome them very easily. So I wanted to try to think about what happens in a child's mind and what happens to the children who witness that. How are they able to perform the operation of the sentimental operation of empathy and understanding? So one of the things that I kept on thinking about while writing this novel was reenactment, not only as that kind of, I think, a little bit bizarre cultural practice of reenacting historical events for entertainment and consumption, but a more internal, individual, psychological process of listening to a story about the past. Or even about the present, but a story that seems distant for whatever reason, and internalizing it so deeply that you kind of reenact, right, through play. I mean, children integrate through games what they hear, right, and what they see and what they witness. So a lot of what I was trying to do was to thread different but kind of. But certainly comparable historical moments in the U.S., such as the relocation of Native Americans and their how they were displaced from their original lands, and also forced relocations and diaspora of people today arriving in the U.S. and then in the children's minds in the novel, these two things kind of mix up and get confused in their games, and they reenact at the same time an event such as having to run away from blue coats and white eyes, and at the same time trying to hide from border patrol and finding a way to survive in a desert, right? So all these things get kind of mixed up and combined in reenactment, and perhaps, I mean, this is speculation on my part as a novelist and someone who's thinking about our deeper psychologies, but perhaps through that reenactment there is the opportunity to have a deeper reckoning and a deeper kind of empathy for others.
You have this adult world and this children's world, and these adults don't really hide much from their children. It's not like they're trying to hide them from the pain of, like the mother is kind of helping a friend of hers who is separated from two of her children, and two of her children cross the border alone, or the death of Native Americans. They're honest about it with them, and you have a page in there where the mother's kind of talking about how she's worried about what to tell her children and how to give them a story. And as she listens to her son telling the story sort of back, she realizes kind of how much they understand what's going on around them. And I think it's something that generally in our world, adults don't really consider how much children can understand if you give it to them.
Totally. I mean, a few years ago, there was this horrible attack in New York where a man ran over people who were on the bike lane, walking or jogging or on bikes here in New York. The next day, after my daughter came back from school, my daughter must have been about 6 years old then, and she came back from school, and I wanted to see if it had been talked about at school or not, and what they had said and how they had handled something like that. And I asked her, "Hey, so did they say anything at school about something that happened?" I wasn't very elegant in asking the question. I didn't really find the right way, but I asked that, and she said to me, "What, Mama? The story about this man that ran over people with a truck?" And I was like, "Yes, exactly. What? How do you know?" And she looked at me like I was an alien of sorts, and she said, "Well, I read it in the New York Times." And I was like, "Okay, of course, right? The newspaper's there on the table always, and of course you read it in the newspaper. And there's the radio, and there's so many ways." So, what I mean, there isn't really an easy answer to any of this. But I have come to think that hiding what happens in the world from children isn't a very good idea. Although, of course, trying to protect their right to innocence as much as possible is something that parents have the duty to do, right? But or I feel that as a duty. But at the same time, I feel that it is a duty to give them the tools to understand violence, understand crisis, understand injustice, and feel some kind of agency in that understanding. And that, I think, comes through a very patient and very committed exercise in storytelling.
This book is destabilizing. It's a destabilizing narrative. Not only this family's breaking up, you're commenting on immigration, but another aspect to it that I thought was interesting was that none of the four main characters have a name. So they're nameless. But then maybe three quarters of the way through or halfway through, they're each given a name basically by each other, the children, that's more of a Native American name, like
Lucky Arrow, Swift Feather,
Memphis.
Yeah. So I thought a lot about naming and the weight of names in storytelling, right? It's something that I've thought about in other books before, right? In books that I've written, my characters are often nameless. In my first novel, they are also unnamed. And then I wrote an entire book, The Story of My Teeth, that is, among other things, a meditation on the weight of names in the fabric of narrative, right? Names as sort of, I think, a metaphor that kind of can help visualize what I'm saying is, if you have a piece of cloth and you throw a very heavy ball into it, it bends in a certain way. If you throw a very light one, it bends in another. It's kind of that was a metaphor or like a visual metaphor that I think a teacher of mine used when I was 13 to explain how gravitational pull works, and I think it just really stuck to me. And I kind of transposed it. I often transpose it to how things within the fabric of storytelling work, right? And a name has a very heavy weight in a narrative. It kind of closes up a character immediately. It gives a character a kind of solidness that I don't like creating so immediately when I start writing, because I don't know what my characters are like. I don't know who they are really when I start writing. And I like to discover who they are as I move along in my writing. And a name seems to just fix that very, very, very solidly too early on. So I like to work with that ambivalence, right? And then what also happens often in narratives that tell the story of population that is going through a moment of political violence or crisis, those sort of actors are often unnamed, right? And so I wanted everyone to be unnamed versus having a family of four with everyone with names, and then sort of everyone else outside that world unnamed, right? So yes, the characters in this novel are unnamed and acquire names. And then the children, because another thread in this novel is the thread about seven children migrating possibly towards the US. It's not ever said explicitly, but it's seven children aboard a train migrating north. And they also don't have names when their story starts, but also acquire names in a similar procedure, kind of echoing, or the two things are kind of echoes of each other, I guess. So the family giving each other new names, and then these children naming each other.
At the end, we talked a little bit about you changing points of view, and that you wanted to sort of, in the whole storytelling frame of stories being passed on and the little boy telling the story also at the end, it was a single sentence, 20 pages.
Right.
And so it had this breathlessness, which, you know, matches what I would think of when little kids are telling a story and they're so excited and they're like trying to get in every last detail. And it's just one thing after another.
Well, nothing has ever been so difficult that I've written in my life. I think a disproportionate amount of time on those 20 pages, maybe 6 months or so, just working on that every day. 6 months out of 4.5 years of writing this novel, it was difficult to find a way of threading kind of the heart of the story, really, where the story about the seven children migrating aboard a train and the story of the two kids that have gone on this road trip with their family, it's where they intersect and get kind of tied together. And what is happening in that scene and in that slice of the novel, to put it one way, is that the two children have gotten lost and are walking south in Cochise, Arizona. And the children who had migrated aboard the train have managed to cross the border, and some of them haven't made it, but others have, and they are walking north in exactly the same geographical space. And so they are walking towards each other unknowingly. And at the same time as they walk, there's a desert storm, a thunderstorm that's forming. So the only point of reference that they have in common, their common horizon, is what they see up in the sky, which is this thunderstorm forming. And so the narrative shifts back and forth between these two viewpoints, sort of the kids walking south and the kids walking north, and it shifts when the narrator looks up at the sky and sees the storm progressing, right? It's one sentence that kind of beats with the rhythm of walking for a very long time under very difficult conditions. There's a kind of timelessness, because no one knows when this trek across the desert is going to end. So time seems that it's just kind of dragging on. And there's a lot of repetition, repetition in syntactic forms and in vocabulary, as in the imagery and the plants and the animals that the kids are seeing around them.
The focus of both parents in this is sound. They are sound documentarians.
I think that sound, as opposed to visual documentation, allows for a different pace in our interaction to whatever has been documented. There's an immediacy of a visual documentation that we consume without necessarily stopping and thinking, right? Of course, there are exceptions and there are images that we need to stand before and look twice and look three times, but there's something in sound that's just different. You can't hear at a glance, right? Sound moves with time, and I was interested in exploring that kind of slowness that seems to be missing from so much in our lives. I'm a radio junkie, by the way. I listen to the radio more than I see movies or videos or anything. That's kind of also just the way that I connect to the world. And I also think that sound, as opposed to image, because we've been so exposed to terrible things in to seeing terrible, horrifying things, sound has a, you know, different effect. I don't know if you remember, but last summer there was that audio from that someone captured in the border while children are being separated from their parents and placed inside the perreras, the cages, and the kids are crying, and some of them are very composed actually, and one of them is giving out his aunt's or her aunt's phone number, and I don't know if you heard it, but it was a document that haunted me for a very long time. I had actually already finished writing the draft of the novel then, but I thought then, hearing that, well, there's some deeper way in which sound reverberates in us, I mean, no pun intended, right? And I think that this novel makes a case for sound and for listening rather than just sound and abstract.
Can you read a passage from an author that speaks to you or influenced you as a writer?
Well, okay. I mean, there's several different things that I could read, and I've been thinking of, actually was in the library today. I've been working in the library this past month just because I'm about to go off on a book tour and become an astronaut and feel that I'm going to disconnect. I spend my days in the library just kind of regathering, right, grouping myself. And I was looking for several things. And one of the essays that I like most is this essay by Sei Shonagon, the Japanese writer. I should tell you the year she was born. It's very, very old. Sei Shonagon, who was born in 1966 A.D., and there's this essay called Hateful Things, which is really like a list, but it's almost like it's a list, and it's a document of the things she finds unbearable, right? Or hateful, as the translation says. I hate the sight of men in their cups who shout, poke their fingers in their mouths, stroke their beards, and pass on the wine to their neighbors with great cries of, have some more, drink up. They tremble, shake their beards, twist their faces, and gesticulate like children who are singing, we're off to see the governor. To envy others and to complain about one's own lot, to speak badly about people, to be inquisitive about the most trivial matters, and to resent and abuse people for not telling one, or if one does manage to worm out some facts, to inform everyone in the most detailed fashion as if one had known all from the beginning. Oh, how hateful. One is just about to be told something interesting when a baby starts crying. A flight of crows circle about with loud caws. An admirer has come on a clandestine visit, but a dog catches sight of him and starts barking. One feels like killing the beast. One has been foolish enough to invite a man to spend the night in an unsuitable place, and then he starts snoring. One has gone to bed and is about to doze off when a mosquito appears, announcing himself in a reedy voice. One can actually feel the wind made by his wings, and slight though it is, one finds it hateful in the extreme. One is in the middle of a story when someone butts in and tries to show that he is the only clever person in the room. Such a person is hateful, and so indeed is anyone, child or adult, who tries to push himself forward. One is telling a story about old times when someone breaks in with a little detail that he happens to know, implying that one's own version is inaccurate.
Tell me why you chose that.
I mean, first of all, absolutely revolutionary about this woman in 900 and something AD, observing male behavior, right, and putting it down on paper. It was a long time until that became a more common practice for us writers, I guess, right? Like being able to turn men into a subject of scrutiny and observation. It has taken us a really long time to be able to reproduce in and when I say us, I mean female writers. It certainly took me a long time to reproduce the gaze that we were trained to have, right? Which is a gaze that looked at female intimacy and at sort of the body of a woman and could kind of be voyeurs of that, but not so with the male body and male behavior, right? We've had to unlearn so many things, but in particular in narrative gaze, I think we've just reproduced the male gaze over the female naked body, so to speak, right? Nakedness said here more as a metaphor than literally. When I read, say, Shonagon the first time, I must have been in my early 20s, and I thought, well, wow, right? I mean, there is this piercing gaze that a woman can reproduce on the page about sort of the intricacies and the small details of male behavior that I hadn't had contact with until then, right? I mean, happily things are moving on now finally rather quickly, but it wasn't easy for a long time for me to find this kind of gaze.
Can you read something you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard to write or changed a lot from the first draft?
So what I'm going to read to you is a couple of paragraphs from the novel that I don't even know if these two paragraphs are the final version, but this is the document I opened. But for a while, I thought, it was a very naive thought, that I could write Lost Children Archive simultaneously in Spanish and English, because I wasn't yet convinced about which language I should use. And then I thought, well, why don't I just do it simultaneously? And of course, that plan didn't work out. I mean, a novel is a lot more than just crafting sentences, right? You have to inhabit a rhythm and a kind of respiration, right? That much like dancing or swimming. So you can't stop all the time and kind of go back and forth and go from one language to the other. But for some fragments in this novel, I did do that. I wrote kind of simultaneously, like a sentence in Spanish, then one in English, and then another one in English, and then that would kind of change what I had originally written in Spanish, and so on and so forth, right? There was this kind of ping pong. And this is one of those fragments. She fills the space in the car with the warmth of her cup breath, her tiny milk teeth a little too separated from each other.
light up in her face whenever she articulates new, difficult words, saguaro, words like sarcasm, not concepts, just words, consequences, cemetery, jacaranda, scapulary. Then quite suddenly, she maybe tires of being in the world, becomes quiet, looks out the window and says nothing. Perhaps it is in those stretched out moments in which they suddenly meet the world in silence that our children begin to grow apart from us and become unfathomable. Don't stop being a little girl, I think, but of course I don't say it. She looks out the window and yawns. I don't know what she's thinking, what she knows and doesn't know. I don't know if she sees the same world I see. Outside the car, the brutalized, almost lunar landscape stretches on indefinitely. Always defend yourself from this empty, fucked up world, I want to say to her. Cover it with your thumb. But of course I keep quiet. She is quiet. She scans the view outside the window and then scans me from who knows which long distance to make sure I'm not looking at her when she slips her thumb into her mouth. She sucks her thumb, and in the back seat, a different silence settles. Her thoughts are slowing down, her body muscles yielding, her respiration layering quietude over unrest. Slowly she is absent, erased from me, slipping back into herself. She doesn't know this yet. But this is how it all ends. All of us, alone together. Her thumb, sucked, pumped, swells with saliva, then slowly slips out as she slides into sleep. She closes her eyes, dreams horses.
Do you want to say anything else about that?
That the rhythm here was very much a product of this kind of going back and forth between Spanish and English, but at the same time, I wanted there to be, especially towards the end, like a rhythm, the same kind of rhythm of thumb sucking, right? It was interesting because I remember that in English, because there are many more monosyllabic words in English than there are in Spanish, it was a lot easier. I could have that thump, sucked, pumped, that kind of reproduces this beat. That is a beat of a child sucking his or her thumb. And in Spanish, but Spanish usually has much longer words. So it was really difficult to find a way in this back and forth that I was attempting with a simultaneous translation to achieve a similar, to have the two fragments sound similar, even though they were written in different languages, if you know what I mean.
Where do you write?
I write anywhere, really. I mean, I like listening to the sounds. I don't need to be in a quiet, isolated space when I'm writing notes for a novel. On the contrary, I like to be around things and people because I usually take notes of what is going on around me, and that is like the raw material for all of my fiction. I'm more like a document more than I fictionalize. Or I fictionalize, but I only fictionalize after I've documented a lot. So I really, in early stages, I write anywhere, but then there is a moment in which I am sort of deeply, very deeply inhabiting the world of a novel or a book. And there I have to write in certain isolation and usually late at night when everything is quiet and mostly in that case, mostly in my studio.
What do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
I don't think I've ever felt the need to get away from writing, as in kind of like run away from it. But I swim almost every day, and I really cherish that space of just breathing and being silent. And it's I usually swim in the morning, so I like to start my day in that space of silence.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
I have two or three very close friends who I trust very much as readers, and it's usually them who have to read the first draft.
How have you dealt with rejection?
I mean, I guess in different stages, right? First, I guess by just feeling miserably rejected. But, you know, I think when I was younger, rejection felt like the dead end of a street. And that was it. There was never going to be another opportunity. Never. Like,
this editor said, no, that's it, right? This piece has nothing. But as time has passed, one thing that I think I have learned is to be patient with work, and it's often the case that when something is rejected, it can be turned into an opportunity for thinking more about that piece and also thinking where that piece really fits. There's so many publishing spaces, and I think that we often kind of automatically think of just the two or three that we want and we like, but there's so many, and sometimes a piece just better fits in another, right? So I think I have gotten a little bit better about dealing with rejection because I'm patient in a way that I wasn't in my 20s.
And what is your favorite word?
My favorite word in Spanish is ultramarino, which is in English ultramarine, I guess. But I don't like the sound of it in English as much as I do in Spanish. Ultramarino comes like from ultra, beyond, and marino from the sea, like from beyond the sea. And I guess that I like that word because the first thing I ever read written by a family member who had already passed, with my grandfather. I never knew him, but one day I came across his letters. They were stored in some boxes in my father's house, and I read them, and he spoke about the ultramarine stores in Mexico where products of his hometown in Italy could be found. It was like a there was a novelty, I guess, or in the letter he was talking about this new ultramarine store where he could, I guess that's what delis were called in Mexico. They were ultramarine stores.
You've been listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest was Valeria Luiselli, author of The Lost Children Archive. You can follow First Draft on Facebook. Just look for First Draft, a dialogue on writing, and click like, and on Twitter at First Draft APR. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. Thanks for listening.